Okay, so here we are. This is chapter 8, first lecture, chapter 8 on inflation. And the first slide says, what is the price mechanism? Well, first of all, the reason that I talk about the price mechanism right from the get-go is I'm trying to convey the difference between any rise in prices and inflation. See, now inflation is defined as a pervasive and general rise in the average level of prices. See, in order for us to have inflation, prices across the board on the average have to increase. The point I'm making here is that not all rise in prices is a bad thing. I mean, why do we want some prices to increase? I mean, why is that a good thing? Well, we want some price increase because that's how the price mechanism works. I mean, how is it that business knows what we want as consumers? Well, business knows what we want through the price mechanism. See, I mean, you know, businesses don't have to go out and give surveys and ask a bunch of questions to find out what we want. See, the price mechanism does that automatically. Well, how does the price mechanism work? Well, you put a new product out there, or any product, but let's say it's a new product. Now, how does a business decide what price to put on that product?
Compared to our competitors.
Well, that's one way. You may look at your competitors, something, see what their price is. You might look at your costs. You might do other type studies, but when all is said and done, it's just a guess what price you're going to put on it. What's the best price? So anyway, you put some price on it, you know, considering all these things. Okay, now what's going to happen? Okay, you got, let's say it's a new product. You put that new product out there. You might put it out there through, you know, maybe you're the wholesaler and you've got retail outlets, and maybe, you know, they've got in their stores, and so there's a price and people are considering whether to buy it or not. And so what's going to happen? Well, if a lot of people want to buy it, but there's not enough for everyone at the going price, how do we decide in a free market who gets and who doesn't get?
Raise the price.
Yeah, it's the highest bidder, right? People bid against one another. Now notice here that it's people bidding against one another, like at an auction, that will increase the price in the market. So who gets? Well, the highest bidders are those who want it the most and who've got the money to pay for it. And other people don't get. See, remember, the basic economic problem is scarcity. We live in a world of scarce resources. So we have to have some mechanism to say, oh, well, if we've got scarcity, some people are going to get and some people aren't going to get. How do we do that? Now, there are other ways that we can decide who gets and who doesn't get beside the price mechanism. Like if this class were full, like it enrollment was at the beginning, who decides? I mean, how is it decided which students get into this lecture section?
First people to sign up.
Yeah, see, it's first come, first serve. See, it's not the price mechanism, not the highest bidder. It's first come, first serve. See, we do have other ways in our economy to decide who gets and who doesn't get, but our system is basically a free enterprise, and the mechanism is what's called the price mechanism. You put something out there, a bunch of people want it, price goes up, the highest bidders get. Now, if people don't want it very much, business is going to find themselves with surplus, and to get rid of surplus, they'll lower the price. So as the price goes up, what information is conveyed from the consumer to the producer? Well, the producer knows that people want more. If the price goes down, the producer knows people want less. See? Information is conveyed via the price mechanism. And secondly, the producer has to have an incentive to give people what they want. So you put a product out there, people want it, they bid against one another, the price goes up. And as the price goes up, what happens to profits for the producer? They're going to make more money, right? So they're going to have an incentive to give the consumer what the consumer wants because of the higher price. But to give the consumer more of what the consumer wants, we might have to build more factories, hire more labor, buy more machines. Now, where's all that money going to come from? Well, ultimately, it comes from the higher price. Higher price, more profit. Now we've got money to invest. Why? To give people what they want. So the important point I'm making here is that is any increase in price a bad thing? Well, no. It's good for certain prices to go up because that's how free markets work. That's how the price mechanism works. So in this chapter on inflation, see, we're not talking about those prices that are going up because of the price mechanism. Inflation's different, okay? So so what we're going to learn in this chapter is, well, what makes a pervasive and general rise in the average price level? Okay. What three roles? See, I got ahead of myself. Convey information, give incentives, provide working capital. What is inflation? A general upward movement in the price level. Which two categories is left out of the core inflation rate? Well, we measure inflation different ways, but the most common way is called the consumer price index. Now, the reason why the consumer price index is so important is that almost all government programs have what is called a cost of living clause attached to them. Well, now what that means is, like, take Social Security. If you're on Social Security and inflation is, let's say, 5%, well, the previous year, well, what happens to your benefits early the next year? Well, they go up by 5%. See, all government programs have what is called this cost of living clause, which says that, well, whatever the inflation rate is, then these benefits will go up that amount, at least on an annual basis. Well, what inflation are we talking about? Because there are different measurements of inflation. Well, the inflation we're talking about in terms of government programs is the consumer price index. So what is the consumer price index? Well, the consumer price index is a certain basket of goods and services that consumers normally buy. See, we have not all goods and services are in this basket, only those goods and services that consumers normally buy. So as time goes on, we might take some things out, put other things in. You know, one time typewriters was in that basket. Well, would typewriters be in that basket today? No, because people don't buy typewriters. You know, years ago, computers weren't in that basket because, you know, people didn't buy computers. Well, now, of course, you'd have to include computers because that's something that people commonly buy. I mean, a short 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, would cell phones be in that basket? It's amazing, you know, cell phones are not that old as an invention. Wasn't that long ago before, well, we wouldn't have cell phones in that basket because, you know, people didn't buy cell phones. Well, today, you know, almost everyone on this planet owns a cell phone. So, see, we have to keep that basket current. We take some things out, put other things in, and then we measure the increase in prices of that basket. And that's called consumer price index. Now, which two categories is left out of the core inflation rate? When we say core inflation, we're talking about the consumer price index. And food and energy are not included. Now, they used to be included, but a couple years ago, the government decided to take out food and energy from the consumer price index. Now, they've got their reasons for that, you know, statistical reasons. But if you look at inflation today, what would probably be going up more than anything else? What categories? Probably food and energy. So if you take out food and energy from the consumer price index, then what difference is that going to make in terms of your measurement from month to month? Well, you're going to get a lower inflation rate. I mean, if you take out those two variables that are increasing in price the most, then you're going to be left with a lower inflation rate. Now, how would that benefit the government? Anybody can see how that would, by changing how we calculate the consumer price index, how this benefits the government? Anybody? Well, remember, I just talked about COLA arrangements, the cost of living adjustment. You know, if people are on Social Security or any other type of government programs, what happens to their benefits along with inflation? They go up, right? Well, what happens to those benefits if we change the definition of inflation so that it reads lower inflation from year to year? Well, the government saves a whole bunch of money because it pays out less money to recipients of government programs. See, if the government were to come out and say, look, we got to save some money here, so we're going to cut spending for people who are on Social Security and are on welfare. Now, how popular would that be? Probably wouldn't be very popular, right? But if the government comes out and changes the definition of inflation, how many people get upset about that? Not many. And yet, it's the same thing, right? I find that interesting. You all find that interesting? What is the recent history of inflation? Well, 46 to 48, 8%. Now, there's a reason for this. World War II ended in August of 1945. Now, during the war, we reached full employment. People were being paid wages, but they didn't have much consumer goods to buy because our factories were producing war material. Now, we call this situation pent-up demand. See, I mean, people got the money. They want to buy refrigerators. They want to buy, you know, this, and they want to buy, you know, cars. But, you know, there are not enough refrigerators available. There are not enough cars available. So demand is pent up. They've got the money. They want to buy it, but the things they want to buy aren't available. So they don't spend their money. Now, the war ends. But it takes time to turn our factories from war materials to peacetime products. You see? So in the meantime, you got people with money, but you got a lot of scarcity of consumer products, so those people bid the price up, and so we get an 8% inflation. But then, by 1948, all our factories now are producing peacetime goods instead of war material. So, we don't have a shortage problem. So what happens? Well, prices come down to about a 2% annual rate. And that's the way it was until the 1970s. And then in the 1970s, prices virtually doubled. So we're going to find out exactly what happened in the 70s to cause prices to double. In just a little bit. Why is inflation called an arbitrary tax? It's called an arbitrary tax because people are affected randomly. Now, how are they affected? Well, if we increase taxes, what happens to your buying power? Or our buying power?
It goes down.
It goes down, right? Well, if prices increase more than your income increases, what happens to your buying power? It goes down. Well, is that not the same thing as increase in taxes? You increase taxes, your buying power goes down. Prices increase more than your income increases, your buying power goes down. But the difference between inflation and taxes is that taxes can be very selective. You know, I mean, if we raise taxes, who's going to pay the higher taxes? Well, that depends on how we write the tax laws, right? We can write it one way, certain people will pay. We can write it another way, other people will pay. But when we have inflation where prices increase more than people's incomes increase, then those who are affected are random. I mean, you know, we can't write in the law, you know, who's going to be affected the most and who's not. People are affected randomly. Now, who is affected? Who's hurt most by inflation? Now, a lot of people would want to say, well, you know, poor people, people on, you know, maybe on Social Security, but that, you know, people living on Social Security aren't hurt at all by inflation. How come? Because as we get inflation, their income increases, right? So who is hurt by inflation? Well, some of the working class, but not all the working class. Minimum wage workers, that's possible. Yeah, that's possible. Because the minimum wage workers may be a part of the category of people who are on a fixed income. See, the best answer to that question is, you know, those who are on a fixed income. See, in other words, if prices are increasing, but your income stays the same, then you're hurt by that inflation. See? Now, whoever that may be. See, who measures inflation? It is published monthly by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And they have different ways of measuring inflation. One of the main ways is that they hire people to go shopping every month. Like I know there's this lady in Pulaski, and what her job is to go shopping every month. Now, can you go shopping without buying anything? Yeah, I mean, shopping says, you know, like, ever heard the term window shopping? You know, shopping is, well, you're just kind of looking. That's mean you're buying, you know. When my wife goes shopping, you know, I don't worry so much. But when she goes buying, then, you know, I got something to worry about. So what this lady does, she's got this list. And she goes into the same stores and she prices certain products that are on this list. And then after doing that for a month, she sends that information into the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and then from all over the country, the Bureau takes these figures and they come up with the Consumer Price Index. So, you know, that's how they measure what's happening to prices. Now, notice here that the prices we're talking about is on that list. And what products are on that list? Well, it's the products are in the basket that, you know, people normally buy. And that, as I said earlier, you know, that can change. It does change as time goes on, as tastes and preferences and new inventions and all of that comes into play. So this is how we measure the Consumer Price Index, which is a measure of the cost of a fixed market basket of consumer goods and services. Okay, I talked about that. See, we also have other indexes, like we have what is called the Wholesale Price Index, which only measures the price of wholesale goods as compared to retail goods. Now, well, one of the advantages of the wholesale price index is that it's a good precursor to what can happen in the near future, because wholesale prices will go up before retail prices. You know, there's a lag effect. So we may look at the consumer price index and we don't have an inflation problem, but the wholesale price index is really getting heated up and it's increasing. Well, what can we expect to happen to the consumer price index, you know, shortly down the road? Well, we can, yeah, it can increase, you see. So that you know, that's one reason that we have what's called the wholesale price index. And then there's another price index called the GDP price deflator index, which measures, it's a much broader category a measurement as opposed to the consumer price index. Instead of just a particular basket of goods and services, the GDP price deflator index measures a much wider variety of goods and services. You know, it's very broad in nature. Now, which is the best index? Well, that depends on what questions you're asking. You know, certain questions you ask, the consumer price index may be better. Other questions, wholesale price index. Other questions, maybe the GDP price deflator. See what I mean? But people normally, I mean, when we talk about inflation, it's the consumer price index that we're really talking about, because that's what affects consumers the most. I mean, right here and now, and especially, you know, if you consider government programs. Because, you know, the majority of the population is on one government program or another. I mean, even you as students, you know, you're on the government program if you've got a student aid. You know, most of student loans now are government loans. And so, you know, most people in America today are, you know, receiving. In fact, the statistics is that the majority of people receive back from the government more than they pay in taxes. Because there are government programs, most people, you know, there are more people who receive than pay in taxes. And what could be the danger in that, by the way? What could be the danger in more people receiving as opposed to paying?
You don't want to pay taxes when you can receive the funds.
But where is the danger?
People won't want to pay taxes anymore.
Well, one danger is perhaps those who are paying may, you know, I mean, if taxes increase beyond a certain point, you're going to get tax avoidance and maybe some tax cheating. But what I'm getting at here is, you know, what is the danger in a democracy?
The minority not being heard.
Yeah, and in this case, you know, minority-majority. I mean, if the majority of people are receiving and only minority people are paying, and you've got a democracy, what can the minority do? I mean, what can the majority do? Well, they can support, you know, laws and politicians that will simply, you know, take more and more away from those who are paying. Right? I mean, see, what is the purpose of a republic? The purpose of a republic, which is a political system based on law, is to protect the minority from the majority. So the republic acts as a buffer against a pure democracy. Okay? Anyway, that's kind of a side note, but that's something we have talked about before. Does this fixed basket change? And I've talked about this. Yes, it's tastes and preferences change. Okay. If inflation is 10% and you get a 7% raise, what has happened to your money income and your real income? Now, we got a couple terms here. When we say money income, that is a measure of how many dollar bills you get in your paycheck. If we say real income, now we're talking about what those dollar bills can buy. Okay? In other words, if inflation's 10% and your income goes up 10%, what's happened to your money income?
Stay the same.
No, your money income. Let me say it again. we got inflation rate 10%, and your income goes up 10%. Your money income goes up by 10%. See, because you're getting 10% more dollar bills in your paycheck. But what has happened to your real income? It stayed the same. So your real income has stayed the same. Because are you any better off? I mean, if your income goes up 10%, but the prices of those things that you buy has also gone up 10%, are you any better off?
Not at all.
Not at all. So your real income has not changed. Okay? So that's the difference between money income and real income. And after all, I mean, what's more important to us, our money income or our real income?
Our real income.
Our real income, yes. So let's say the inflation is 10% and you get a 7% raise. What has happened to your money income? Well, your money income has gone up by
10%.
No, you get a 7% raise. So your money income has gone up by 7%. But what has happened to your real income? Yeah, it's decreased by 3%, you see. Your money income has increased by 7%, but your real income has decreased by 3%. Now, see, if prices increase more than people's incomes increase, of course, their buying power goes down. So what happens to unemployment?
It goes up.
Yeah, it goes up, exactly. You know, as real incomes go down, people buy less, business sells less, they lay off workers. Now, what is the percent increase if your income goes up from 30,000 to 32,000? Anybody know how to work this math? What is the percent increase as you go from one number to another number?
Index.
No, how do you calculate it though? Mathematically. How do you calculate a percent increase? Well, you calculate a percent increase between two numbers by taking the difference and dividing by the original number. Like in this case, see, the difference between 30,000 and 32,000 is 2,000. Now, what's your original number? 30,000. So 2,000 divided by 30,000 is 6.7%. So if your income goes up from 30,000 to 32,000, that's a 6.7% raise. Now, what I'm getting at here is that if your income goes up from 30,000 to 32,000 and inflation is 5%, are you better off or worse off? Well, you're better off by, but not by the whole 5%. You're better off by 1.7%. See, that's why, you know, in economics, economists like to measure things because, I mean, we want to know, well, are things getting better or are things getting worse? And if they're getting better, how quickly are they getting better? If they're getting worse, how quickly are they getting worse? So as you go up and, you know, take more advanced courses in economics, you're going to be involved more and more in measuring things. Now, a big part of measuring what's happening in the economy is to try to discern, well, are things, you know, getting better or worse? And so, I mean, what's the percent increase or decrease from, you know, one time period to another time period? Or, you know, one variable to another variable. So all the time in economics, we're using mathematics as the percent increase or decrease. So you always take the difference between the two numbers and then divide by the original number. Now, as they're going to show you, if you divide, okay, bye-bye. She told me she had to leave early, so I really do appreciate that. What happens if your income goes down, let's say, from 32,000 to 30,000? what would be the percent decrease? Well, now it would be the difference between the two numbers, but what's the original number? It's not 30,000, it was to 32,000. See, it used to be 32, but now it went down to 30. So the percent decrease would be the difference between the two numbers divided by 32,000, because that's your original number. That's why if you always use the word original, it's going to work whether you're talking about an increase or a decrease. All right? It's the difference between the two numbers divided by the original number. And that will give you the right answer, either a percent, either increase or decrease. Now, what is the rule of 72? This is just a handy mathematical approximation that people like to use. If you take any percent increase and say, let's say inflation's 2%, and we're going to extrapolate that out and say, if it were 2% every year, how long would it take prices to double? And that's where you'd use the rule of 72. 72 divided by 2 is what? 36. So the rule. So if we had a 2% inflation rate, this says that it would take 36 years for prices to double. Now, what happens if we have a 10% inflation rate? How long will it take prices to double approximately with a 10% inflation rate? Well, 10 goes into 72 about 7 times. So with a 10% inflation rate, prices will double in 7 years. Or another way of using it is, let's say that you put your money into a savings account or some kind of somewhere where you can get a 10% return on your money. So you put $1,000 in, and let's say you're getting 10% return. Now, how long will it take your $1,000 to equal $2,000? About 7 years, right? 72 divided by 10 is about 7. So you put in $1,000, and then you wait. Well, in 7 years, you'll have $2,000. In fact, the rule of 72, I include this here in this chapter because it fits to give you, approximation of the impact that inflation has on the economy. But the rule of 72 is really a financial thing. I use the rule of 72 in my personal finance course, because if you're into finances and investing and, stocks and bonds and all that stuff. Well, investors use the rule of 72 a lot to get, approximations of returns or losses. But it comes in handy here. See, at 2%, how long would it take prices to double? 36 years at 10%, it'll take 7.2 years. All right. Now, what gives anything value? There are only two things that give anything value.
If it's scarce and demand.
Yeah, and demand would be, you're exactly right. The term that I was thinking of is usefulness. If something is useful, then there's a tendency for demand to be high. So, but it's anything has value dependent upon its usefulness and its level of scarcity. Now, can something be very useful but not have much value? Yeah, the water that we get from the drinking fountain can be very useful, especially if you're thirsty. But it doesn't have much value. Why? Because it's not very scarce. Now, what does scarce mean in economics? This goes back to an early chapter. What? Scarce means, because it's not rare, Scarce doesn't mean something rare.
Or not enough of something for people to get it for free.
For free, exactly right. It's exactly right. Scarce means there's not enough to go around for everyone who wants it for free. Okay? Now, if there's not enough of something to go around for everyone who wants it for free, then how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get? Well, that's where the price mechanism comes in, right? And that's what, so anything that has a price, by definition, is scarce. Otherwise, it would be a free good, and it would not have a price in the market. Okay? So anything has value because of usefulness level scarcity. The more useful it is and the more scarce it is, then the higher will be the price. And again, we're talking about free markets here. See, what gives a country's currency value? Well, the goods and services of a country which there is a demand. See, money has value. Now, you know, why do foreigners want to possess American dollars? Because Americans have things that foreigners want to buy. Well, how can they buy? They need American dollars. So the demand for the dollar, there is a demand for the dollar on the international market, which gives the dollar value on the international market. Now, if you show me a country that doesn't have anything that people want around the world, then how much value would that currency have? Well, it would have no value. Okay? See, what I'm really getting at here is, you know, before we really get into, you know, causes of inflation and all, I'm trying to make a distinction of, you know, what inflation really is, because you got to understand value and what gives things prices to begin with and how the price mechanism works before you can understand what inflation really is. Is there anything wrong with this slow and steady rate of inflation? In other words, is all inflation bad? And the answer is no, especially when inflation is anticipated. You know, a slow rate of inflation, you know, 1%, 2%, 3%, year after year, nice and steady, totally anticipated. That kind of inflation need not cause any problems at all. In fact, it may even be good for the economy. All right? So, you know, slow and totally anticipated, steady inflation, not a bad thing. But when can inflation be a bad thing? Well, when it's just the opposite. See, not only is it just high inflation that can be damaging, but it's erratic inflation. You know, prices go up 4% one year, 12% the next, 2% the next, 25% the next. I mean, you know, people don't know what to expect. You know, the inflation is totally unanticipated. You can't anticipate what inflation is going to be because it's so erratic. Well, see, that kind of inflation is very harmful. See, because why do why do investors make investments? Well, they make investments based on their expected rate of return. You know, investments are made based on expectations of what's going to happen in the future. Well, if you've got erratic inflation and investors don't know what to expect, well, they become fearful. You know, they become too cautious in terms of investing. And that's bad for economic growth. Now, same with consumers. You know, consumers have to, you know, plan somehow. I mean, some plan better than others, but I mean, everyone's got to, you know, have some idea of, oh, well, you know, this is going to be my income and this is what I can buy with my money. But if inflation's going up and down and you don't know what to expect, well, it's hard to plan. See, so unanticipated inflation, especially erratic inflation, is harmful for to both the consumer and the producer. And especially, of course, for the economy. Now, we can talk about inflation as simply being a rise in the average price level, but that's very mechanical. It's, you know, there's not much emotion to that. But inflation can change society in fundamental ways. It's more than just an increase in prices, or it's more than just a decline in buying power. So how does inflation change society? It breeds uncertainty, diminishes buying power, erodes real savings. Now, what's real savings?
Money earned but not spent.
Well, savings is defined as money earned but not spent. All right? Savings, you're exactly right. Savings is defined as money earned but not spent. But real savings is anything that has value, that that retains its value. Like a real savings might be a boat that you have, or maybe an antique car or something. You know, that something that's going to, even when the economy goes south, you know, it's going to have value. I mean, in the market, you know, I mean, if you've got real savings and things get bad and maybe you lose your job, and well, you can always sell what you've got. I mean, it's very sellable. It's very marketable. So when you have you know your money tied up in things that have that retain their value, then economists call that real savings. Okay? So anyway, inflation changes real savings. So in other words, you've got an antique car or a boat and it's got a certain value, but if we have a high rates of inflation, what happens to the value of those real savings? Well, they go down. I mean, you know, when you sell that boat, you're going to get more dollar bills for it because of inflation, but if inflation is increasing more and people's income's increasing, then in real terms, you're going to get less. So inflation has an impact on real savings. That's the point being made here. And, of course, it causes inflation. Why? Because when prices increase more and people's incomes increase, demand goes down and we get more unemployment. You know, that's a tie-in between inflation and unemployment. And it alters social traditions and confuses the price mechanism. Well, alters social conditions. You know, places like fast food places like McDonald's had a tremendous growth spurt in the 1970s. Now, what happened in the 70s is that we had an average annual inflation rate of about 10% a year. Now, if we have an inflation rate of 10% a year, as we did in the 70s, how long did it take prices to double? About 7 years, right? Using the rule of 72. So every 7 years, prices were doubling. Now, how many people's incomes were doubling every 7 years during the 70s? Very few. So if prices were increasing more than incomes were increasing, what happens to people's real incomes during the 70s? Real incomes went down. And when real incomes went down, people are strange. I mean, we all are. It's a social observation that all of us are reluctant to change. I mean, some more than others, but people basically are reluctant to change. And usually, the older you get, then the more set in your ways you become, and the more difficult it is to change. And very few people will go above and beyond to have more than what they have been accustomed to. See, we all become comfortable with our state in life. I mean, you know, whatever environment you grew up in with your parents, especially material-wise, you know, the neighborhood you lived in, the type of cars, you know, your parents drove, you know, any activities they participated in. I mean, you know, whatever they did, whatever their lifestyle was, that's what you're comfortable with. And very few people will go above and beyond to have more than what they've been accustomed to, because they don't want to leave their comfort zone, we call it. But when will most people change? Because change is painful. People will change when they're faced with losing what they have been accustomed to, whatever that is. See, whatever your state in life is, I mean, you could be, you know, a high living standard, low living standard, but you know, whatever it is your state in life, whatever it is that you're comfortable with, once you're faced with, you know, losing that, then you're going to be willing to change. And that's what happened during the 70s. What happened during the 70s, you see, is that prices were increasing more than people's incomes were increasing. You know, their real buying power was going down. So a lot of people were willing to change. Now, what major change took place? Well, a major change took place in the 70s was the second income. You know, before the 70s, the one-income family was the norm. I mean, if you would paint a picture for me of the typical American family before the 70s, you know, like during the 50s and most of the 60s, you'd have a picture of a single-income family, and, you know, they would have a certain lifestyle. The wife and mother was, you know, home full time. She was raising the kids. You know, they didn't need daycare or anything because she was home full time. The family ate together on a regular basis because she was, she could do shopping during the day, and she had time to make a nice warm meal. And about 6 o'clock, you know, the whole family came together and had a leisurely meal together. And this was a lifestyle of the average American family. You know, that's when Leave It to Beaver and you know, those shows became very, very popular. Well, what happened? Well, what happened is that we got inflation, and people were faced with losing what they had been accustomed to. And so what was the answer? Well, the answer was for the wife and mother to go into the workforce. Now, at first, a lot of them said, well, you know, we're really struggling here, and we're faced with, you know, losing our house and we can't buy a new car every 2 or 3 years like we used to. So if you go to work just temporarily, you know, we get some of these bills paid off, and as soon as we get back on our feet, well, you can come back and be housewife again. But, you know, that's not the way the world works, because, see, once more women went into the workforce, after several years, what became the norm? Well, the norm then became the two-income family. And that's what people became comfortable with, you see? So you may be reluctant to change, but something forces you to change, so you change, but then after a while, well, that new situation becomes comfortable. See what I mean? Besides, I mean, you know, with that second income, did most families take that extra income and pay off their debts? Or what did most families do? Come on now, you think most families took that extra income and paid off their debts? What did they do?
Bought cars.
You know, bigger house, exactly. And so now what happens? Well, yeah, their income's increased, but they've got a bigger house, they got a bigger mortgage, they got 2 cars. I mean, see, with one income, you only needed 1 car. But now you got 2 incomes, and you need 2 cars. You see what I mean? And plus, now you're paying for daycare, which you didn't have to pay for before. And see, all your expenses are going up. So instead of paying off your bills, well, your debt simply increased. You know, you live in a bigger house and you drive a bigger car or a newer car more often, but those are just material things. And now you're locked in. Now, you know, that second income person, which is usually the wife and mother, now, you know, she can't, quit because we've got all these, you know, now we've got more debts than we did before. Now, what point am I making here? What caused that? When the two-income family becomes the norm and people are now more in debt than ever before, society changes. See, that has changed the inner workings, the very fabric of society. Lifestyles change as a result. Well, what caused that huge change in lifestyles? It was inflation. Right? It was inflation of the 70s that caused these monumental changes in society. So the point I'm making here is that inflation is more than just an increase in prices. It's much more than that. Inflation can cause unemployment. Inflation can cause changes in our lifestyles and how we live our lives. It changes the very fabric of society. You know, that's my point. Okay? And it affects all of us. You know, this isn't something you just, you know, read about in an economics textbook or, you know, listen to it, you know, in this lecture here. I mean, you know, these things affect all of us greatly, whether you know about it or not, by the way, right? I mean, you may not know anything about gravity, but if you jump off a 10-story building, you're going to fall to the, you know, you're going to fall, you're going to go splat either way, right? I mean, just because you didn't know about gravity, it doesn't mean that you're going to not suffer the consequences. And same with this stuff. You know, whether you know about inflation and whether you know about how the economy works, doesn't make any difference. You're going to pay the price one way or the other. But I would rather have knowledge and maybe I could do something about the situation than be ignorant. Does that make sense? How the inflation of the 70s affects society. Fast food restaurant, you know, that's interesting. When you got one income, well, you know, wife and mother does the shopping and she cooks dinner and the family comes together. But now you got two incomes and Johnny's got a baseball practice, you know, every evening at 6 o'clock. And so what are you looking for? Well, you're looking for, let's go out to eat. But we don't want to go out fine dining, right? You know, we don't want candles and nice tablecloth and wine and all that. I mean, we want something quick, right? You know, we want to go out and have something that, you know, can fill our bellies and get to the baseball game. And so what happened? Well, McDonald's, Burger King, you know, places like that. They, you know, fast food restaurants became popular during the 70s. How? Why? Because of inflation. See, that's another way that inflation can change society. Now, what causes inflation? Now, after all of this, you know, so far this lecture here, I've been talking about, you know, what inflation is and how we measure inflation and the results of inflation. But, you know, what causes inflation? Now, there's one overriding cause of inflation, and that is that the money supply has to increase more than goods and services increase. You see, can businesses cause inflation? Businesses cannot cause inflation. Impossible. Now, let me give you an example. What would happen if tomorrow morning all business owners woke up and they said to themselves, I think I'm going to raise my prices by 10%. So all business owners raise the price by 10%. Now, if you look at that, you know, in that day, what's happened to inflation? Well, all prices have increased 10%. So you might say, well, that's inflation. But it's really not inflation, because what is inflation? Inflation is a pervasive and general rise in the average price level. Because, you see, if all prices go up 10% overnight, what happens to our buying power the next day? Come on, what happens to our buying power if all prices go up 10%, you know, in a day? They go, our buying power goes down by 10%, right? So what are we going to do? Well, we're going to make priority purchases. You know, we're going to say, well, you know, I mean, I'm still going to pay my rent, or, you know, my mortgage. I'm still going to make my car payment. I'm still going to, do this. But, you know, I can't go out to eat like I used to. Or, you know, I can't buy that, you know, new computer I've been, you know, wanting. I've got to save up for that. So we start making priority purchases. We, you know, we buy some things and we don't buy other things. Well, as consumers quit buying or slow down their consumption of certain goods and services, those businesses find themselves with excessive inventory, you know, surpluses. They cut back production. They start laying off workers, employees. Well, now people have less money, you know, more unemployment. Buying power goes down. They buy less. Business sells less. More in excessive inventory. And more unemployment. And next thing we know, I mean, you know, a month or two later, we've got a big unemployment problem, but what's happened to prices? Come on, what's happened to prices? Yeah, they go down because, you know, we're getting growing unemployment. See, in other words, if all businesses said, oh, well, we're going to raise prices 10%, that's not going to cause inflation. I mean, it might for a day or two, but before long, prices are going to start to come down. Why? Because those higher prices are going to lower people's buying power, lower their real incomes, and we're going to get growing unemployment. And as demand goes down, prices will come down. Now, what are we left with? Well, we're not left with inflation. We're left with unemployment. See, can business owners cause unemployment? Yes. But can they cause inflation? No. Or can consumers cause inflation? No. I mean, in order for us to buy more, our real incomes have to increase. So, I mean, what causes inflation? Well, the only cause of inflation, real inflation, is to increase the money supply more than we increase goods and services. If goods and services of GDP increase by 5%, but we increase the money supply by, let's say, 10%, then everything else being equal, we, after a time lag, we can expect about a 5% inflation rate. All right? Now, we've run out of time, so I'll talk about this next time. What I'm really going to get into next time is what really causes inflation, okay? So I'll see you all next time.